Well, good day and welcome to another episode here of the Disaster Podcast. I'm your host, Jamie Davis, the pod medic, and it's great to join everybody again here on the Disaster Podcast. We're going to have a discussion here about, as usual, recent things in the news, and actually that's going to be the topic of our episode tonight, where we're going to be talking about the recent shooter incident in Orlando, where 49 people were killed and 44 or 45 other people. I have to check the numbers on that again, but I think in mid-40s, other individuals treated at the local trauma center for their injuries at that incident. Just a major incident. Everybody's probably seen a lot about this in the news, but we thought we'd talk about it a little bit from the perspective of the responders and the hospital that was close by and dealt with the casualties as they came in. And so we'll get into that here in just a second. Of course, my co-host is here with me, Sam Bradley. And Sam, we've been reading a lot about this.
Yeah, and it's a discussion we just have to have, Jamie, because so much of it are things that we've talked about in essence in other segments. We've talked about the need for tactical training. We've talked about triage. We've talked about hospitals versus CMS and handling these larger incidents. To the extent that it gets involved in disaster teams, I mean, but this kind of puts it all together. And this is the largest attack in the country since 9/11. And it's just mind-blowing. I'm not, I don't care that much about getting into the politics of it, that the people that want to do that. But we do want to look at it from the perspective of EMS and certainly the hospital. And we have a couple guests with us tonight that can reflect well on that. We have Andy Tenner, Dr. Andy Tenner from UCSF, who joined us on another episode, who also works for a training hospital. And the nice thing about the training hospitals is they have a lot of resources that they can pull into play if they have a larger incident like this. And I'd be willing to say that San Francisco is probably ripe for a large incident like this. And we'll tag Andy on what kind of preparedness they do at UCSF. We also have our friend Kevin Reiter from Texas. He used to be in New Jersey, but now he's in Texas and teaches wilderness safety. He's an EMT, used to be a dive medic. All-around interesting guy. So we're going to jump right into this. I'll say hi first. Kevin, how you doing?
Howdy. It's a little cool down here. It's only about 93.
Oh, sorry to hear that. Well, it got hotter here in Colorado today. So, but it's not as humid.
I warm up.
Deal with the heat. As long as I don't have your humidity, I'm quite happy. So, hi, Andy. Nice to have you back with us. How are things
hi.
Out here in the cool city of San Francisco.
It's actually really lovely today. It's in the 70s, very pleasant, so can't complain at all.
Excellent. We didn't ask you about Baltimore, Jamie. How's it been back there?
It's actually been, pretty typical for June. It's been in the 80s, getting close to 90 all week, and we get our afternoon thunderstorms pretty regularly, just like we always do, which drops a lot of humidity on us in the late afternoon.
Well, I'm getting used to that, too, because Colorado's much the same. I think we got one moving in as we speak. So this event in Orlando, which was just a mind blower. Well, it is and it isn't, as much as, you hear this thing and you go, oh, my God. On the other hand, it's unfortunate. We've kind of learned to expect them. We've heard about them on smaller scales, school shootings and that kind of thing. But this one was amazing. It was a very large venue. There was something like 300 people in this club. And the lone shooter went in there and managed to kill 49 people and injure. And like you say, we're looking for the exact statistics. As we go through here, I do have some of the statistics from the hospital that maybe I can touch on. But, in the beginning of this thing, of course, it caught everybody by surprise. But they wouldn't. And it reminds me very much of Aurora, Colorado, where the active shooter incident was still in play, such that police were not going to allow any responders into the building, which makes a lot of sense. So they basically were bringing people out, and people were being treated as they came out. And at one point, I guess they even ran out of ambulances such that they were transporting people by any means they could.
I'll tell you, Sam, it's interesting. Before the ambulances even got there, the bystanders were just carrying people the two blocks to the Orlando Regional Medical Center. So the transport started on foot before the first ambulances arrived, which is interesting to see. And there's lots of news footage of that occurring where people, you know, they pulled in the cell phone videos people shot of bystanders carrying people down the street with gunshot wounds.
Well, and that had to be a bit of a departure for the ER folks, who are kind of used to having a little bit of notice that the people are coming, and they probably knew pretty quickly that this was a big chaotic situation and it was going to get a lot worse before it got better. But I guess even the police, when they went into the venue, it was dark, the lights were out, and the only light they had is from the spinning disco ball. And it sounds kind of morbid, but, you know, what they saw was the dance floor covered in blood, and there were bodies and bullet casings and that kind of thing. So you can imagine from the police perspective, you know, what this was like. But it sounds like those police officers had some basic EMS training, because they started actually triaging people, trying to handle open wounds and checking pulses and doing that kind of thing. So it sounds like they did some level of triage. I don't know if you know anything about the police in Orlando, yeah, but it sounds like they had their act together.
They were able to pretty quickly, a security guard on location and two responding officers engaged the individual pretty rapidly, and forced him into one of the bathrooms where he holed up with some hostages for about 3 hours. And then during that 3 hour time frame, and this just came out today as we were recording, just before we recorded this, but the FBI released the timeline that showed that during that 3 hour time frame, that was when they started pulling the wounded and injured out while they kept the shooter holed up. And tried to negotiate with them. They were still triaging and pulling bodies out, and live individuals out. They were leaving, you know, those that were deceased, but they were getting the wounded out to the sidewalk, basically dragging them out to the street where they could start to treat them and manage their injuries and get them transported. And the hospital got a call for a shooting at a local nightclub. And, you know, the doctors in the press conference I saw were just saying, we expected, you know, we're a major metropolitan area. We hear gunshot wounds. We get them pretty frequently. We thought maybe one or two people. And then it was one or two people, and then it was four people, and then somebody tells us that they're lined up in the hallway with gunshot wounds. And I can only imagine what that must have been like. And Andy, I'm sure you've read the reports and probably seen some of this footage. I can only imagine what it would seem like to you, how you would think about that in your ER.
Yeah, you know, I think my heart goes out to all of the Orlando responders, because I think, you know, this is the thing that we're all trained for, but it's the thing that we're all dreading. You know, this is not what you want to have when you come into work in that day. And trying to sort through who is going to be, you know, when you have that many, you know, usually a gunshot wound patient, when they bring those patients in, they get a lot of resources. They get, especially, you know, when you're in a trauma center, there's a lot of coordination of activity around one or two of those patients. Having 50 of those patients, that would be, you know, you're starting to go through and saying, okay, who needs me right now? Who will need me in 5 minutes? And you're trying to triage to figure out how quickly and what kind of resources you have and who can go. And patients that would go to the operating room normally right away are going to be waiting, because there's other patients that have to go before them. And so, I can only imagine the chaos that initially came in with those patients, and then the daunting task of trying to organize that chaos.
Well, I'm amazed that they actually did 26 operations. And it sounds like, first of all, they called in everybody that could wield a scalpel. But secondly, they were actually, these docs were like literally running from one room to the next, to the next, to the next. So I can't even imagine. It sounds like it was a real organized chaos, that somehow there was a level of organization that these people knew exactly what they were doing and exactly where they were going.
Yeah. You know, I don't know the details of the Orlando Hospital's disaster plan, but it sounds like that they had thought this through and were prepared, because there's, you know, that level of patience is something that you know, often you're not necessarily prepared for. So to be able to organize that and to be able to save as many lives as they did, they should really be commended for their response to that.
They mentioned that they'd done some sort of tabletop drill a month before for a mass casualty incident.
Oh, really?
And so I don't know what the numbers of the staff were involved, but some level of staff were involved in that planning process. So they were doing what they needed to do to try to be prepared, as prepared as you can be. One of the things that the chilling quotes I remember was one of the trauma docs saying that they were telling the news how they were triaging. And I think it was something that I'd never really heard come from a hospital setting before. It was more something I expected from an EMS setting where they were, he said that they were trying to figure out, like you said, which patients need to go to surgery, which patients can wait a few minutes, and which patients we can't help right now. And what can I do to make them comfortable?
Yeah. Exactly.
And that was chilling because it was basically saying, you know, there are some patients, they had to make a decision on the scene, on the spot, which patients can we spare the resources for and which are we going to have to, you know, let die, or maybe you're too far gone for even us to save and we have to acknowledge that and move on.
Yeah.
Given the number of patients you have. Right. So Andy, you're the ER doc that day. And it happens in San Francisco. What are some of the first things that you would do?
Yeah. You know, I think the first thing that you have to do is take stock of what you have. Who do you have? What kind of resources do you have? How many operating rooms do you have available? How many surgeons do you have? And you start making phone calls to try to get everybody that you can in that is reasonable. One of the interesting things about this kind of a scenario is that you also have to realize that you're not those patients that are coming in. There are some that are going to need the operating room right away, but there are some that are going to be delayed. So you're going to be treating these patients for hours to days. And so staffing your department, you actually have to think about that. So you don't want to call in everybody and have everybody come in and then 12 hours later have everybody be exhausted and have nobody else to come in. So you have to set up shifts. So the first thing you want to do is figure out who you have available, how many people you think you're going to need. And then you call, there's a handful of people you call and say, go to bed right now because we're going to need you in 12 hours. You need to sleep and we'll see you in 12 hours.
I'm sure they'll sleep well.
Yeah, I know. That's a tough
really tough
demand. Yeah, but you know, you have to make sure that you have resources and shifts because this is going to be a long, drawn out event. Even though it's it's an acute event, but those patients, you're going to have patients that are going to need to go to the operating room hours to sometimes days later because of triaging your resources. I think that you know, one of the things that that hospitals have to do, and one of the things that in particular trauma centers have to do, is you have a disaster committee and you have drills. So I think one of the things that that Jamie you mentioned that's incredibly important is drilling in these scenarios. So having those things. Having those plans outlined ahead of time when it's calm and you can think through it. So activating those resources that you've drilled and that you know how to mobilize. So in a mass casualty setting, we switch to a different type of charting. We switch to a different type of triage. We actually will go to more of an EMS field type triage because, you know, no matter whether you're in a building or you're out in a field, having needs that overwhelm your resources are the same. And so trying to figure out the most efficient way to manage those patients coming in and manage with the resources that you have is really, really important. And making sure, you know, ahead of time, obviously, you want to make sure that all your staff is trained in that and understands what's going to happen when those patients come in. And then the next thing you do is you try to clear out the emergency department. So anybody that is too sick to go home needs to be admitted, and they have to move up to the admission floors, which oftentimes those doctors are not used to taking patients that are partially worked up. But they have to. You need to make space in the emergency department because you need to be able to take in the influx. And then for some patients that you normally would spend more time working up, you have to say, "I'm really sorry. We're about to get a lot of very sick patients. If you can follow up with your primary doctor, seek care later, go to another hospital. You know, that's, you have to explain to them what's going on. We obviously, you know, with the laws in the U.S., we can't turn anybody away, but you want to make sure that people that are waiting understand what's happening and that it will be a very long time before they're seen and that they can make a decision to seek care somewhere else if they have to. But the most important thing is making space and making sure that all of your nurses, your transporters, your techs, and your physicians in the emergency department are free to take on new patients so that you can try to manage the influx of patients in the most efficient way possible.
And I imagine when the after action reports come through that your hospital administration would take a good look at that and see if they can identify anything that Orlando did that you guys might go, oh, hey, you know what, that's a good idea. Maybe we should think about that.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, this is a scenario, this type of scenario is one that nobody wants to see. And hopefully, you know, it's you know, we hope that it's rare to see. So we do try to learn from all of these scenarios and it helps, you know, these kind of scenarios will help us in our disaster planning to say, you know, what went well, what did they do well, what kind of things were unexpected that we need to prepare for so that we're better prepared in the future if something like this happens at any other facility.
And like you said, that's why you have disaster people. They Yes. are the people that would sit down with their committees and really dig through this and say what was done well, what didn't do so well, how can we make sure we do it right,
yeah,
if and when it happens to us.
Absolutely. And, you know, one of the things that's really important about these disaster committees is it's not just hospital staff. You have to have a hospital plan for the disaster, but it also involves EMS, it involves police, it involves other facilities. Because, you know, one of the elements of our disaster plan, if we have to, if our hospital, you know, this is becoming it's an increasing challenge for emergency departments having overcrowding. So the hospital's full, we're boarding patients in the emergency department that are admitted and shouldn't, you know, their emergency medicine workup is complete, and but there's no space for them at the hospital. So one of our policies for if that happens and we have a mass casualty incident is we have other hospitals that we have affiliations with that maybe don't have the trauma capabilities that we have and so wouldn't be seeing the trauma patients that we would be seeing. And so they will take, we'll transfer some of our admitted patients to those hospitals, to those facilities to try to get them, to free up space in our trauma center. So, you know, working as a system is really, really important in this and trying to tap into community resources is key.
That makes perfect sense. And I worked in Contra Costa County in the east side of the Bay for a long time. And they had, you know, to the extent that they had the money to do them, we always had system-wide drills that involved virtually anybody that would be involved, whether it be in the field or the hospital or anywhere else. And I was looking at through my notes here, they were saying that a trauma center generally handles 4 to 5 patients a shift in terms of trauma. They had 44 in that one evening. And you were talking about the if you triage them, gray, Jamie, the folks they couldn't do much with, there were about 9 of them. Mm-hmm. But they had 27 that remained hospitalized, including 6 in intensive care. And they already know that 2 of the people in the ICU may be permanently disabled. But, you know, overall, they did a fantastic job. And I think there's a lot that this will be an event that a lot of hospitals can learn from, especially the ones that may not be as well prepared as yours is, Andy.
Well, you know, I think one of the challenges to disaster medicine everywhere is that people don't really want to think about it or invest in it until it happens. And then everybody wants to know why it wasn't, you know, why there were mistakes or things weren't managed appropriately. So I think it's a wake up call that we really need to prepare. We need to drill. We need to have the policies and the procedures in place ahead of time, so that we can save lives and try to minimize the damage and destruction that some of these events can cause.
Yeah. And you're right. Go ahead, Jimmy.
No, I was just going to say, and there's also the way that hospitals have pulled together, I think, in the aftermath of this incident. I was pleased to hear that when they were talking about some of the trauma dealt with by the staff themselves, not just the patients, but their own personal stress and trauma from dealing with this incident. That other hospitals that had dealt with these things had reached out to Orlando Regional Medical Center, from Boston that dealt with the Boston bombing victims, from Paris that had dealt with the recent situation there, San Bernardino, Aurora, Colorado. Hospitals in all those areas reached out and, you know, sent basically, you know, their best wishes and some of their protocols that they learned for dealing with the aftermath and the stress for the physicians, nurses, rest of the staff that were all there dealing with this. And so it was good to see that, because I think that that's something that is not thought about. You deal with the patients, but there's a lot of stress and trauma associated with, you know, the post-traumatic incidents of that the staff deal with.
No, at every absolutely. Level, yeah, at every level. And in fact, one of the things they did in this situation that was rather unique was they called in a number of EMT, I guess they were students or paramedic students, to just stay with the family members, of which there were many, I'm sure, just to spend time with them and hold their hand and make sure they had something to drink and just to kind of be there. And I thought that was really an excellent idea. I don't know that I would have thought of that. But, yeah. You know, sometimes you just need somebody there.
Right. Well, you know, it's interesting. So 2 points to that. One, the solidarity is really important among responders, because I think all of us know that that could be us one day. And so, you know, our night shift nurses and night shift staff sent a bunch of pizzas to the Orlando Emergency Department the next night as a sort of show of solidarity. And when, you know, when we had the Asiana crash several years ago, we had other emergency departments around the country sent us food for the staff at night just as a show of support. And I think that's really important, because it's a really challenging thing for the responder staff to deal with. It's emotionally challenging. You have to try to put your own emotions away so you can manage the patients. And I think knowing that there are other people out there that understand, you know, the position you're in and what you're going through and support you is really important. The other point that I wanted to make is with the EMT students. I think it's that's a great idea, and having that kind of support for the families is really important. One of the things that we do in our disaster response protocol is that we actually have medical students, because medical students are often there. We've got a lot of them in the hospital, but they can't necessarily help with the clinical care without supervision. So one of the things that we have as our policy is that medical students will be assigned to patients as they come through and will be the patient advocate. So in the chaos and confusion, that medical student knows everything about what's happening with that patient. They make sure that their charts get taken, you know, because we generally switch to paper charts and something like this. So those charts follow the patients, that they're imaging, and all the information goes with the patient so that nothing gets lost in translation and that the patient has somebody that's there with them throughout their this ordeal, so that there's somebody that's they know is assigned to them and that is taking care of them and advocating for them during.
Yeah, the benefits of a teaching hospital is having
absolutely.
Folks like that you could put into other roles, but everybody will have a role in that kind of thing. Yeah. And actually, I'm working on a guest, Jamie, that's a CISM expert that really wants to talk specifically about Orlando. So, and you know, that's always been a big topic for us in any of these situations, because virtually anybody involved at any level, and you know, the way you were talking too, Andy, you know, we just get into a work mode and we do what we have to do. We don't think about it. And then after the fact is when we, you know, it hits us. And so we have to make sure that virtually every one of our providers is taken care of. But when I was reading through some of this material, our friend Greg Fries over at EMS1 made a comment, which I think kind of really puts it together. He says, each time a mass shooter strikes, EMS leaders and field personnel need to reassess their individual and agency preparedness for a similar incident in their community. In the days ahead, we will learn more about the incident, the response of Orlando police and fire departments, and the heroic actions of bystanders and responders to save lives. There's a lot of stories that are going to come out of this. There's a lot of good learning that'll come out of this. You know, basically what you were saying, Andy, in terms of really looking at your hospital, your community, all of it really has to be taken. And I think that the good thing, that there's always something good. I'm the eternal optimist. There's always something good that comes out of something bad. And I think, well, we will learn some things from this event that we can carry into the future.
Yeah, definitely.
You know, what do you think?
Well, Kevin's been quiet. I was
going to toss it to Kevin because we've been, you know, he's been sitting there quietly in the background. What do you think, Kev?
Yes, I agree on everything.
So in terms of training,
a lot of things.
In terms of training, I know you just want to get out there and do some of this stuff, huh? He's a disaster responder, ready to go out there and change the world. So we need to.
Maybe tomorrow.
Maybe not tonight, but maybe tomorrow. Because I know that, you know, you do a lot of training, especially in the wilderness arena, and you certainly appreciate the benefit of good training. And Jamie, what do you think?
Well, I think it's important to recognize training, and it's a good opportunity to segue into why it's important to train. You know, everybody on the show tonight's talked about the necessary evil of training and preparing for these types of things, and so often you don't know, even some agencies, some organizations, some hospitals don't even know where to start with that process. And that's why it's important to have an organization like Paragon Medical Education Group, our sponsors here at the Disaster Podcast, who can help you by coming in. They're experienced disaster responders from all levels who will come in and help your organization or your jurisdiction manage a major incident, prepare for that, do that big drill that you've been wanting to have but don't even know how to get it started. They're famous for doing their cadaver labs, where they actually bring in and do cadaveric training situations where you're actually managing an actual gunshot wound on a cadaver, just like you would see in a patient in the field. And so hopefully you can help you to train to understand how to manage these traumatic injuries a little bit better as a responder, or even all the way up to managing these patients into the hospital setting. So check them out. They're over at ParagonMedicalGroup.com. You can find them on Twitter at ParagonMedEDU, and you can also find them on Facebook by looking up Paragon Medical Group or Paragon Medical Education Group. And we want to thank them for continuing to sponsor the Disaster Podcast. Reach out to them. They got a brand new website up, and check them out. And maybe they can be that resource that can come in and help your organization be better prepared should something like this, God forbid, come into your community. And it just seems all too common. You know, Sam, I remembered one of the things that was said that struck me. One of the physicians that was interviewed about this in the aftermath, they asked him what he thought about how they did with the handling of so many patients so quickly. And he said, it was my worst day, and it was also my best day. And I found that interesting and profound, because it really said a lot about that individual, and I think he spoke well for his entire staff. They really all stepped up in the worst of times to display the best of what they had to offer. And I think that's all any of us can hope to do. So I think that's where I would leave this today.
That is a phrase I'm always going to remember, because it's so true. While you're in the middle of it, and it just feels like chaos, and you don't know what everybody else is doing until you can sit down and really look at the whole and realize what a good job you did and how many people you actually saved, that's when you get to the aha moment and go, we're good at what we do, and we planned for this. And if it ever happens again, we're going to be ready for it, God forbid. But that is such a perfect statement. I love that.
So, Andy, where can folks find you, or where would they, if they want to find out more information about UCSF, is there some place they can look and find you, either on Twitter or maybe somewhere else?
Yeah, so the UCSF Department of Emergency Medicine webpage, it's ucsf.edu. There's links to me there. There's links to the work that we do. And then my Twitter handle is at Andy Tenner, A-N-D-I-T-E-N-N-E-R. If you want to follow.
Excellent. Well, we'll definitely put that out there and have those links in the show notes. And thanks again for sticking around and doing this second episode with us when we recorded this.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me.
Kevin, how about you? Where can folks find you?
They can find me at wildsafety.com. And I have links to all the social media profiles right there where they can find me here on the Disaster Podcast.
And Sam, how about you?
And I was thinking maybe they'll find Kevin in some austere place in the world sometime soon.
Tomorrow. I need a map tomorrow, of the yes,
Well, you can find me in the usual social media places under Sam Bradley, Sam Bradley 11, or at the disasterpodcast.com website, where we hope you will come and let us know what you thought of this episode. I thought it was pretty darn good. And let us know what else you'd like us to talk about, or if you have any guests that you think would be good to have on our show. We're always open to new things. What about you, Jamie?
Well, you can find me under the handle PodMedic in most social media circles, and of course here at the Disaster Podcast site, where we want you, like Sam said, to come and leave a comment on this episode or any of our episodes and check it out. There's also links there on how to subscribe to the episode, so you can get the information updated whenever a new episode comes out every Thursday. And of course, we want to hear from you, so please get back in touch with us. We'd love to hear from you. You know, Sam, this is a situation that none of us want to have, and certainly isn't something that is going to happen every day.
No, and it's hard to call this austere medicine, but it is disaster medicine, even if it's the middle of San Francisco or Orlando, Florida, because it is a disaster when any hospital or any pre-hospital care system has to stretch themselves to accommodate this many patients in such a short period of time. So it's just another example of disaster medicine. It's not our everyday medicine.